and all the organizers for bringing together this very disparate group of people and producing this really interesting meeting. So the stage is set, right? We've had a white dwarf. It's evolved to about the Chandrasekhar mass. We have IRCA modified convection getting things nice and turbulent. All we're waiting for now is one little spark, which is going to ignite the burning front, which is going to deflagrate this thing. So the problem is flame ignition is a really, really hard problem. It's a highly nonlinear process. It's necessarily a very transient process. It involves the interactions of nuclear burning, conductivity, hydrodynamics, each of which individually are very nonlinear in this situation. So it's a difficult process to model. And yet we know it's important to model, right? It's been known for quite some time that the number and the location of the little kernels which will become flames can determine the success or failure of a supernova explosion and can certainly modify how successful one would look. So what we'd like to do then is understand that. And then once the ignition starts, then you have the first stages of burning. The ignition can potentially happen on extremely small scales, certainly far smaller than are going to be resolved by any large-scale simulation. So what we have to do, basically, to do these large-scale simulations ideally, is to take some turbulence convective initial condition and map from that to a sea, to a sea of ignition kernels, and from that to enough burning process that you can then resolve it in a large-scale simulation. We're not going to get there in this talk, but what I am going to do is tell you a bit of the work that I've been involved in on a couple stages of this. First, some very simple points about ignition, some very, very simple stuff about just one zone ignition. A little bit more interesting stuff, but very little on igniting flames, and something a bit more about igniting detonations. From there, what happens next? You have some phase of early burning. Some work that's been done there, where you get very naturally sort of a characteristic size of flame bubbles, and it's sort of fun to think about what the consequences of that are. This might be a good time to remind ourselves of what a flame is, what a detonation is. A flame is a subsonic burning front. It propagates through conduction, so stuff burns, heat diffuses outwards, the next stuff burns. Detonations, on the other hand, are supersonic. They propagate by shock heating, that's what ignites the next stuff. So the little contributions I'd like to highlight here are some done with work done with Frank Timmies at Los Alamos. Some just quantifying one zone ignition times, nothing really new there, just getting them accurate. And reminding ourselves, again, something not especially new, but reminding us that it's very, very hard to ignite, especially at low densities. You need more than just supersonic flow. There's a geometric constraint. Another bit of work I'd like to highlight is work done with Mike Zingali at sunny Stony Brook. And there, the upshot is that under given circumstances, there's sort of a characteristic size of a flame bubble, and that's what things will burn to initially. Larger bubbles are shredded by their own motion. Smaller bubbles burn out to that size. And then these characteristic size can have consequences, potentially modifying how we think about flame models. So the ignition stuff, ignition, like I've said, very complicated process, involves lots of different physics. And even if you take away most of the physics, the hydrodynamics and the conduction, and just take a look at one zone igniting, it's still not completely trivial. You put a little box of fluid in, you let it start running away. And the amount of time it takes to run away, you get by integrating over the potentially very complicated reaction network. So we did some work sort of trying to map out the ignition times for these conditions. It's sort of important to get this stuff right, right? The stuff that finally does ignite is going to be necessarily on the very tail end of your PDF, of this turbulent PDF. And there's a big lever arm there if you get things wrong. So it's important to get these ignition times calculated correctly. And it sort of is a necessary input for any ignition model. So we ran, a bazillion of these calculations, got sort of a fairly good fitting function for this. You can see that's like 15 orders of magnitude, so that's good. And it's very little surprises, but a couple. Like, well, for instance, there's a surprising dependence on the ignition time. On even fairly modest amounts of neon in the material, can drop your ignition times by 30% or something. That's sort of surprising, and you're going to hear a bit more about some of the consequences of that in the next talk by Ed. So like I say, this ignition time is a necessary input to any sort of ignition model. You know, obviously, if the ignition time is has to be faster than the hydro or conduction time scales for stuff to actually take off. It also gives you fairly directly other little bits of, you know, tidbits of information. So for instance, it gives you the size of a detonation, a characteristic size of a detonation, the distance behind a shock that stuff will actually ignite, right? It's just this ignition time times the detonation velocity. So that's a long way from what you'd really like to know. What you'd really like to know is, given some horrible turbulent situation, you know, which of these hot spots are going to be the ones that pop off? But that's really hard in multi-dimension. So what we've got here is data experiments from Cambridge of ignition. Unfortunately, the colors here are a little different, so it's hard to see actually how almost identical these are at early times. All that's changed, this is a counterflow flame, fuel in the bottom, air in the top, little spark. And these guys are almost identical at early times. There's certainly lots of hot little kernels there, but this guy just completely goes away, whereas this thing keeps burning. So flame ignition in multi-Ds is really, really hard. We've done a little bit of work just with simplified setups, modeling these turbulent hot spots as just little spherical Gaussians in a quiescent flow, trying to map out what in the engineering community they'd call flammability limits. And so, but even in this simplified situation, the parameter space is huge, and this is work that's ongoing. Something you can say maybe a bit more rigorous stuff about, though, is ignition of a detonation. Detonations are a lot simpler than flames, right? There's you know, no conductivity in the problem, none that matters, and the hydrodynamics is much simpler. So the way a detonation ignites is that there's some, you know, catastrophic event, some small point, and then a shock starts racing outwards, stuff behind it starts burning. When that when that shock slows down to a detonation speed, then you may be able to smoothly transition into a detonation. So how, you know, people have asked this question, you know, several times before, how big a region or how much stuff do you have to explode to actually successfully ignite a detonation? There's a very you know, plausible sounding naive answer. The very plausible sounding naive answer is you need kind of a detonation thickness's worth of stuff, right? Certainly less than that, you won't get that detonation. That's a very plausible answer, and it's completely wrong. You know, factors of thousands wrong. This has been known in the chemical community for quite some time, and it's known in the astrophysical community for quite some time too. But we were able to sort of make it a little bit more rigorous. The basic thing going on here is that curvature strongly modifies detonation. You're really directly messing with the coupling between the shock and the burning front. And so, you know, an uncurved detonation has this speed. If you start curving it, the speed plummets quite abruptly, and eventually the detonation will just stop, just fall apart. You can't have a steady state detonation past a certain curvature. That radius of curvature sets the minimum size of a region that must sort of all collaborate somehow to give you a detonation, right? And this is, you know, where that curvature comes in, you know, depends on the equation state, the energy release, that sort of thing. But, you know, for our sorts of detonations, turns out to be kind of like 5,000 detonation thicknesses fairly robustly. What does that correspond to in physical sizes? Well, it depends. Detonation thickness depends on the conditions. But, you know, by 5 times 10 to the 7, for low carbon fractions, this is already sort of kilometer size, a little bit more sort of sizes. And, it, you know, it gets much, 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 much larger as you go to lower densities. So it's really hard for a purely local process to ignite a detonation. On the other hand, as has already been mentioned, it's extremely easy to completely spuriously numerically ignite a detonation, right? This has been known since certainly at least Ewald Mueller's work in the 80s. Jens Niemeyer has recently rediscovered this when he was doing this work. Can a detonation pass through ash and survive? If you don't resolve a detonation thickness, then you can easily, completely spuriously ignite a detonation. All right, so that's basically everything I know about ignition processes. There's a lot of work to be done. So the next thing is early burning process. So what happens next? So you have a little ignition that's going to ignite a flame, right? Not a detonation. So what happens next? Well, it's pretty simple. You get spherical burning outwards. You get a buoyant rise of this hot ash. And you can get turbulent disruption, not necessarily disruption, but distortion of this spherical flame bubble. Each of these has some characteristic velocity associated with it, right? And you can sort of deal with these semi-analytically. You, thanks to, for instance, work by Frank, you know what the flame speed is at given densities, different conditions. The others, distortion by turbulence or buoyant rise, are going to have something to do with the bubble size. The buoyant rise velocity, that gets back to sort of classical fluid dynamics, bubbles rising in water or whatever. But you can sort of build pretty good models for what a typical, terminal velocity that's rising bubble is. And, the basic story here is that the spherical burning out of this flame bubble is always going to win until the bubble gets to some size where one of these two other effects matters. I'm basically only going to talk about buoyant rise stuff, the turbulence stuff. The turbulence on a given scale is sort of comparable in some sense to the buoyant rise velocity, right? It's the turbulence is being driven by convective motions, which are driven by buoyancy motions. So they have something to do with each other, and it turns out buoyancy generally wins or is more dramatic anyway. So there's some size, some characteristic size, where this flame speed stops dominating, buoyancy effects start mattering. In the core here, it's sort of kilometerish size. Sort of drops off with density, right, as the degeneracy is slightly lifting, buoyancy matters more and flame speed reduces. So what, the dots here are semi-analytics, the line here is sort of a crude fit, one which works, one which doesn't. So what happens next? What happens when buoyancy starts winning? Well, this is a movie taken, from a simulation in a different context, but the idea is still the same. Once a hot bubble starts rising, it just gets torn apart. And it has to, right? There's nothing holding these bubbles together. There's no surface tension in these situations. Now here's a simulation done in a different context, a more explicitly 1AE context. And it's the same thing. Hot stuff rising is going to tear, get torn apart. And that's what's going to happen to flame bubbles. Vortical motions, this isn't, by the way, Kelvin Helmholtz instability or Raleigh-Taylor instability or something. This is simpler than that. This is just the vortical motions by the thing's own rising, just tearing it apart. So this is always going to happen, right, unless something prevents it, which is to say, unless the flame speed is burning out faster than these buoyant motions can tear it apart. So basically, as long as the flame speed is staying more or less still, as far as I can see, it's growing faster than it's rising, it stays intact. Once it starts rising faster, it gets chewed up. You can imagine turbulence, it turns out, doesn't chew up the bubble faster than the buoyancy does. The buoyancy wins. So again, you get this characteristic size. This is now not just a balance of two velocities. This is kind of the size a bubble wants to be. Smaller bubbles not burn out, bigger bubbles not get chewed up. So, for instance, this sets now a reasonable initial condition size for a large-scale simulation. If you have kind of if you put sort of half-kilometer-sized flame bubbles into your large-scale simulation, you haven't missed any dynamics. That's exactly all that happens. So that's semi-analytics. Of course, nothing is true until a computer tells you so. So we compared these calculations to computations done with this great code developed at Berkeley Labs with Mike Singali and the Berkeley crew. And so this is actually evolving a flame in a flow. So this is really important, right? If you're trying to understand basic flame flow interactions, you need to actually compute both the flow and the flame. Right. If you put in, instead of evolving a flame, if you put in some flame model, the flame does this, then you've already assumed something about the flame-flow interaction, right? In particular, at the very least, you've assumed that the flow doesn't affect the flame. There's no back reaction, and this is demonstrably false. So for this figure may not show it perfectly, but in this case, for instance, this cusp is burning out much faster than the flame is burning up on the stagnation line. That's factor 1.5, factor of 2 almost. This is something like, this is logarithm of carbon destruction rate. So that may not be the very best plot to show this, but maybe you can see this structure certainly extends much further, and there's no red on this plot, whereas there is a red on the bottom here. So there's a factor of 0.5 in logarithm base 10. Yeah, this is 2D. So this is a good point. So this is 2D simulations of comparing our semi-analytics. The semi-analytics say buoyancy should start mattering right about here. Sure enough, it does. Flame bubble gets distorted, starts getting pulled apart. Because this is 2D, the pulling apartedness of the simulation can't really be trusted. The geometry here is going to differ in 2 and 3D. Although, that's been done with sort of in other contexts with these hot rising bubbles too. So you can't actually, for the tearing apartedness, you actually want to do the 3D simulations, which is something that's being worked on. But for where distortion starts happening, that's insensitive to 2 or 3D. So that definitely tells you about early burning, and it definitely tells you, what is good and useful to put into a large-scale simulation. But it starts a mind to wondering. So most flame models that are done in this biz, the sort of picture is you have some sort of planar flame and it gets corrugated as it propagates upwards. And that's informed by small-scale terrestrial experiments, and that's informed by experiments like this, of which this is numerical experiments like this, of which this is the very best there is currently, done by, again, Mike Zingali and the LBL group and Stan Woosley and that group. And so in these sorts of simulations, you can kind of get 50-ish flame thicknesses in a box. You get turbulence and RT corrugation. And sure enough, when you restrict yourselves to a box that size, that's all you get, right? You get a little box, a planar but wrinkled thing moving up. And so, of course, that's what the flame models sort of give you. But in the supernova, you have a much larger range of scales than this. There's much more degrees of freedom than just wrinkling of a planar surface. So you can imagine something like this happening. You can imagine one of these flames igniting, bubble starts rising, bubble gets big, bubble shreds itself. And then presumably it happens again. The bubbles are small now, buoyant forces are relatively small, they start burning out again, this happens again and again. So if this happens, and it basically has to happen in the initial stages of burning, there's nothing else going on, this gives you a very rapid increase in burning volume. And it's a very different sort of picture for modeling how the flame burns than one of these planar sort of situations. And if you start thinking about that, well, that starts getting very interesting because look, the size these bubbles wants to be starts dropping rapidly in a sort of a very suggestive range of densities, kind of several times 10 to the 7. So these bubbles want to suddenly be much smaller, so they'd want to fragment into many, many small bubbles, which would give you a rapid increase in burning area at a very interesting time to get a rapid growth of burning area. So thus ends my talk. So for the conclusions, we have one zone ignition times, which, not all that interesting, although this is interesting little hint of changes with metallicity. It's hard to ignite detonation. It's hard to properly ignite detonations at low density. Flames, and then the rest, flames want to burn out significantly, like a kilometer at the core, smaller as you go out before they start to rise. Initial conditions need roughly that resolution. Turns out that's basically available now. And so there's this typical burning size. And then slightly more speculative, you have a rapid decrease in size. Does that lead to increased burning? Or is that just another way of describing sort of distributed burning? And is a planar flame model appropriate? And I think it certainly isn't at early times, but is it ever? Thank you.
Thanks for that clear talk. Any questions? Oh, Lars first. So I was surprised by your comment about the vertical flow tearing it up. So could you give us a sense for what's the effective Reynolds number of your flow? Well, it looked like a low Reynolds number phenomena.
It's only low Reynolds number because nothing in those simulations we haven't put in the external turbulence you'd have because the turbulence doesn't matter initially. But it can be a low Reynolds number flow in the following sense. It almost doesn't matter what the Reynolds number is. You have a bubble, a light fluid and a heavy fluid, absent any surface tension forces. The thing will rise. It will generate a vortex ring that will shred it. Though in this case, it's a very smooth manifestation of that. No, it's not. So even no boundary layer, right? So imagine just potential flow around a sphere, right? So there's these motions like this, but the sphere isn't rigid, right? So the converging flow at the base is just going to keep going, and it's just going to fall apart. There's nothing in the world to keep a hot blob of gas intact in this situation. So these were actually computed with absurdly high resolution. Unfortunately, it doesn't show it because there's not a lot of flow features to really see. But these are simulations which resolved both the flame thickness and boxes, which in some cases, not the ones I showed, but in some cases were, several hundred flame thicknesses in each direction. So there was a lot of resolution there. The numerical Reynolds number was extremely low. Well, it's absurdly high in that these were sort of 1,000 by 1,000-ish simulations, but it's absurdly high in terms of, other than the flame, you can see there's not a lot of other features. So naively, you'll see this very smooth flow, and you think 1,000 by 1,000, that's kind of overkill. But to resolve and compute the flame, that's what you need, at least locally. These are AMR calculations, so there's some. It's not globally 1,000 by 1,000.
Well, Jonathan, I can give you color versions of this plot of Iapichino you showed. But to your last point,
right.
I think it's not quite fair because in these models, it's not really a planar flame model. What we model is a flame brush that has a big size, much, much bigger than the flame width. And so it's, in that sense, it's not a planar plane. So many of those effects you're talking about are built into the way the flame brush is constructed. So it's not just that people say, okay, take some real flame, a sheet, and so on, treat it like that. The models that do this kind of simulations have a different picture. It's not really a planar flame model. I want to stress that because leave people with the impression that, if you really do a turbulent flame brush, it's not like a planar flame model.
Well, so that's fair, but. Maybe this distinction I'm making isn't really planar versus non-planar, but one large plume with a finite thickness. I mean, so you've got a big plume, some finite thickness of burning going on at the forefront of the plume, right? But you have one burning surface.
But the burning is in the entire flame brush. It's not in the bubble. But the burning zone in that sense is the full size of the flame brush. It has all these turbulent eddies in, and so it has all this volume by definition. Right. So the volume you are going for is built into the flame brush. So we correct for the different volumes on different scales. So in principle, that was the kind of picture Stan had brought up many, many years ago about the fractals. So this is built in.
So
all these scales are built in.
I certainly don't want to be misleading. Planar, this obviously isn't a plane. But it's
a thin sheet.
It's a thin sheet.
Yeah, right. But this is not really what the models do.
So, Jonathan, I have one question that is, I think, pertinent to the very early phases. So we always start with bubbles. You have DNS calculation, and actually the Reynolds numbers that we really have in the real system are much higher than any kind of ridiculous numerical resolution that you can actually achieve or use. Second point is, we do know...
So what?
Sorry?
So that is completely true.
Right.
So let's take a look at this simulation.
Maybe next picture, the one by Luigi.
But this is the same simulation.
Right.
So it turns out.
No, I didn't finish. Jonathan, I didn't finish.
All right.
So we know from validation experiments, of bubbles, that we are in the regime of extremely high Reynolds numbers and very low surface tension. So we do know that actually this Tsingali's experiment with toroidal bubble is probably right, and what Luigi's seeing, that the shredding of the bubble is probably also right. They are probably numerically unstable for different reasons, but we have a shredding picture, okay? So the bubble doesn't really survive. Now, that bubble doesn't involve in a static background flow field. There's a turbulent flow field. So those shreds are actually, you know, dispersed, okay? So now my question to you is, what is the chance of any shred to self-generate itself, in the sense generating the next bubble?
So that's a very interesting question. So let's move to this. I have the correct answer for you. The correct answer is I don't know.
The flame never dies.
But that's also pretty close to a correct answer. So it's almost impossible to extinguish a flame, right? And the reason it's almost impossible to extinguish one of these nuclear flames, you can make fairly sophisticated arguments, but the basic idea is that it's really hard to extinguish a flame by throwing fuel at it, right? These things will certainly get shredded, but they're not naturally going to get shredded to smaller than flame thickness unless the velocities are much, much faster locally than a flame thickness, and that's almost impossible. So some of these certainly will survive. I think that's basically the answer.
I think your approach is very valuable here. I just wanted to make three comments, very short ones though. One is that in your ignition time that you were discussing, there's actual several ignition times, the one to burn carbon, the one to burn oxygen, the one to burn silicon. And in fact, the splitting of the carbon flame into multiple components may be crucial to the triggering of a detonation. The second was in your criteria for detonation, it's also important to consider the possibility that you have ash mixed in with the fuel, again in the context of triggering a detonation, because the Q value, the yield, radically affects the critical mass. And then finally, on the floating bubbles, you showed things that were essentially two-dimensional.
Right.
And Mike and I found very different results in three dimensions. Right. You had the picture of the 3D bubble on the screen there a minute ago.
It's here exactly for this sort of question. So in inverse order, so in a quiescent medium, and you see this in many different contexts. In a quiescent medium, a sphere won't hold itself together, but vortex rings can be very stable. But if you have now a turbulent medium where you have a turbulence kind of comparable to the rise velocity, then these things can be broken apart. So what you really want to do is do these high-resolution 3D simulations in a box where there's external turbulence of the right amplitude, so you have to resolve the whole turbulence. So that's really hard, but you're absolutely right. Just left to itself, the 3D analog of these simulations, because we're missing this external turbulence, you'll get these beautiful smoke rings that will just last forever and ever and ever.
Okay, we have 1 minute left for another hot question. Dean, do you have any desire to say anything? Okay, thank you very much.